What I'd like to do is give a little introduction about the Medical Committee for Human Rights, who we are and what we do, and relate some of the personal experiences that I had as a member of the first aid teams at San Francisco State, and then show a movie that we made to back up some of the points and some of the charges and some of the problems that we see as one of America's health problems, namely the police. The Medical Committee for Human Rights is a national organization of allied health professionals, physicians, nurses, students, and allied paramedical workers, namely social workers, lab technicians, hospital administrators, people like this. We arose out of the need to provide medical care to the civil rights workers and blacks in the South when it became apparent that existing health facilities were discriminating against these people. Since then, the Medical Committee has expanded nationally to provide a forum and personnel to implement changes in the health profession consistent with a humanistic approach. In keeping with the notions of, quote, medical presence, end quote, which is a complicated concept that simply means having trained health personnel present at times when they may be necessary, for example, any confrontation between strikers and the police, we accepted the invitation of the Third World Liberation Front, the Black Students Union, and members of the American Federation of Teachers to provide medical presence at San Francisco State College. People always ask us, well, what preparations had we made prior to this? And we feel that medical care during civil disorder is woefully inadequate. We've been prepared to provide this care at many levels. And despite a divergence of political beliefs, the Medical Committee for Human Rights takes a neutral position when functioning in the role of a health professional. Specifically, this means that we do not deny treatment to anyone, demonstrator, striker, onlooker, or policeman. We do not hinder the police in making a, quote, lawful, end quote, arrest, nor do we engage in the demonstration with the strikers. In the summer months of 1968, when a ghetto-based riot was feared, we approached the Department of Public Health and the Police Department with our concern that the existing health facilities would be inadequate. We made specific recommendations that we thought would be minimal to preserve the vestige of humanity under such circumstances. I personally, with other members of the Medical Committee, met several times with representatives of the Department of Public Health, including the director, Dr. Socks, specifically with Chief Cahill, Deputy Nelder, and the Police Commission. We reiterated our positions of medical neutrality and were assured by them that we would be allowed access to the injured. Dr. Socks of the Public Health Department sympathized with our concern and promised medical assistance. At the outset of the disturbances at State, I contacted the director of student health, who indicated that they would treat all emergencies that came to the student health service. They had no provision whatsoever to provide immediate treatment away from the actual physical building of the student health service, and that no organization to transport the injured people to them was in existence. Thus, we felt that all available means to supply care to the injured were explored, and these were found to be totally inadequate. This necessitated a major effort by us to provide this care. From the outset, all the assurances given to us by police were disregarded. As will be elaborated subsequently, we were unable to reach the injured, and in many cases were singled out and mercilessly beaten by police units. Moreover, recently, Mayor Alioto supported the police action against the Medical Committee for Human Rights, the doctors, the nurses, and the medics, denying them, quote, immunity from the police, and thus he reinforced the right of the police to run amok in any confrontation, to be totally unreachable in terms of medical care. What was the composition of our group? We operated at three levels of training: physician, nurses, and medics. The medic had to be competent in first aid technique and willing to function in a neutral capacity. Many of the medics were youth counselors trained by the medical committee during the previous summer. Many were students at State who saw us in action and wanted to join in and help, and after preliminary first aid courses were then allowed to do so. Volunteer physicians were present in addition to myself at various times. During December, when the levels of violence were higher than in January, at least two and up to eight physicians were present on campus all the time. Two nurses were present every day, supported financially by us, and up to 10 nurses were present at any one time. We averaged about four nurses per day over the entire 2 months. Nursing and medical students, as well as the medics that we had trained, functioned as medics. There were between 8 and 14 medics per day. Everybody was clearly identified as health people wearing white coats, wearing red armbands with MCHR written on them, and after the first day, most of us had white helmets with red crosses on them. What did we do? We administered first aid to the injured we could reach. We treated people who were indirectly affected. For example, an elderly man was walking on one of the picket lines and began hyperventilating and had a seizure. A person waiting for a streetcar was bumped in front of the car and was injured. We also tried to treat people who were injured and arrested and denied medical care by the police, and then after they were released, we treated them. The most important thing I think we did was provide trained professional people who exerted a calming influence on both police and strikers, thus helping to contain the hysteria and panic which frequently flared. I feel we forced individual policemen to control themselves, and often were able to intercede when a policeman had lost control and was wantonly and illegally beating students. All of us were clubbed, insulted, harassed, and prevented from functioning by the police at one time or another. I'd like to give some concrete examples of the violence that I saw. Much of this will be subsequently shown in the film. And I'll try to divide this into four categories. One would be the direct action of the police against the strikers and bystanders. Two would be the care of arrested people prior to booking. Three would be care in the jail itself. And fourth would be the post-release care. And I'll cite from December 3rd, which was what we called Bloody Tuesday, when the police had began making sweeps on the students in the commons areas, swinging their clubs like baseball bats. They were ordered to keep one hand on each end of the baton, but frequently they would grab them and swing them. Several students sustained body blows when one line of police swept them one way and another line would sweep them the other. Several students were knocked to the ground and were kicked as the police ran by. At one point, after I'd received several blows by police, I saw a policeman fall to the ground near the library, and I ran over to him and tried to get through the line of police that sprung up around him. And I was wearing a regular house officer garb, white coat, white pants, carrying a black bag, and I had a crash helmet on with a red cross. And despite the fact that I was recognized as a doctor by the police guarding the man, I was clubbed on both arms and told to get the hell away. Ironically, later, I was taken care of the same policeman in the emergency room at the San Francisco General Hospital. I saw a black student later who was clubbed with his scalp split open. He was dripping blood, and he was semi-comatose. He was dragged by the police toward the wagon. Some of his pictures are on the screen around here. They stopped periodically and beat him repeatedly, despite the fact that he was handcuffed and barely conscious. Dr. Rose, who will be speaking later, and I approached the ring of police and asked to be let through to stop his bleeding before he was thrown in the wagon. We were pushed back with clubs. I then circled the approaching ring of police, hoping to find a more sympathetic policeman who would let me get through and put a bandage on this boy's head. I again identified myself as Dr. Fine and asked to be allowed to treat the arrested person. One of the police yelled, "Get that motherfucking doctor." And what looked like six members of the tactical squad jumped at me, pushed me to the ground, clubbed me repeatedly on the head, kicked me in the testicles, slammed me in the back of their clubs, and goaded me in the stomach. A group of faculty and students ran up and began screaming at the police who were beating me and pulled them off of me. At no time did they ever request me to stay or indicate that I was under arrest. I witnessed on another day a priest standing quietly at a line of approaching police. He said loudly, "Arrest me, I will not resist." He was still saying that as they clubbed him to the ground, opening up a gash in his head requiring 16 stitches. I saw police club young black girls who were running away from sweeps. I witnessed a policeman club one of the nurses in the head. Tactical squad officers would swat our nurses in the rear end and make sexual comments about their clubs when they turned around to see, you know, why they were doing this. I saw police stand and urge the blue armband students who were beating a girl that couldn't have weighed over 100 pounds. She subsequently had a broken nose and a fractured zygoma. I saw police repeatedly rush in and beat strikers that were fighting among themselves. I saw police club a crowd in front of people in order to get to someone behind the crowd, when 5 minutes before that, the same person was walking in front of the same line of police and a nonviolent, peaceful arrest could have been made. This tactic was employed over and over and over again, usually against black student union leaders, and presumably this was to initiate fear for the picket line. I witnessed the indiscriminate use of mace, which was then outlawed by the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco. Later, it was released by Dr. Sox under strict conditions for use, which were flagrantly violated. I saw students held by police and maced. I treated students who claimed they were maced in the wagons. I saw medics, male and female, being clubbed and pushed by police, despite their policy of non-interference with the officer making an arrest. I heard about a student who was struck in the chest and was lying in the library. We got the establishment physicians from the health department to come over and get him out of the library. They were told that he had left an hour ago. 45 minutes later, he was removed from the library and rushed to the hospital where he had an emergency splenectomy. Our nurses report seeing people arrested with no visible injuries and seeing them come out of jail with black eyes, mace burns, skull injuries. I treated one serious case who sustained a fracture of his arm and a probable skull fracture in transit to jail from the arrest site. People without visible injury were uniformly denied medical care by the arresting officer and taken to jail. In the jail, only the people who had obvious bleeding sites were taken to emergency treatment centers. I know of cases of students who were refused medical care despite the fact that they were coughing up blood all over the jailers and subsequently had broken ribs and lung contusions. I treated over 12 students who claimed to have received their injuries while in transit to the jail. I know of 4 cases of people with chronic disease who had their medications taken away from them. One case, a girl who was on twice-a-day doses of insulin had her insulin removed, and another had his anticonvulsant medication taken. These were never returned. All of these situations were predicted by us in June, and as far as we know, there are no steps taken to improve the care of these groups of people. It became the rule at the bail bondsman that if a person was charged with more than one felony, he would need a physician when he got out. Unfortunately, this was invariably true. And I've tried to describe some of the violence I wish I witnessed at San Francisco State, as well as tried to convey the harassment and the selection of health personnel by police as targets for violence. Many times, I or the nurses or medics were warned by individual policemen who we had treated or established some rapport with earlier that they were out to get us today and to stay away. I cannot condemn the entire police force at San Francisco State, but wish to focus on the incredible atrocities committed by a large number of police that you'll shortly see in the movie. In the press, various captains were quoted as admitting that they couldn't control their own men. And as a physician, I can say that many of the officers are severely disturbed and a menace to the law they're serving. I fully expect this conflict to escalate, if not at San Francisco State, then elsewhere, and will not be surprised when the police pick up machine guns and mow down rows of protesters, as was recently done in Mexico. Their wanton abuse of power negates the entire democratic disguise of authoritarian structure. I can only hope that the professional community will be able to provide a group who will help keep violence at a level consistent with the magnitude of the problem. The time has come for us to remove, as Freud said, the mask of assumed indifference and to confront the sources of violence in our society. Thank you.
Dr. Larry Rose, a noted San Francisco ophthalmologist, is going to talk about mace. I'm going to listen.
First, it's hard for me to follow that film. The film speaks for itself. I just want to add a couple of things that Dick wasn't able to say, because one day I was there, he wasn't there. During the day when they made the 450 arrests, they came in, and I think many of you have seen pictures here relating to that and heard a lot about it. I just want to make one thing clear, and that is when the police moved to make the arrests, their announcements of the arrests were not heard by most of the people that were standing there. They made it through a bullhorn on one side of the crowd, and they then surrounded the crowd, ran around them very quickly, and started hitting people with their clubs and pushing. More pushing and jabbing than hitting, but some hitting too. And I was standing on the outside watching it. And then one police lieutenant was spraying mace into the crowd. And then people were yelling for medics inside the police ring. And at that point, I asked to get in. And the police lieutenant who was in charge repeatedly said I couldn't get in. His badge number was 209. And he said he knew who I was, and he wasn't going to let me through. And then finally he said, well, if you insist on getting through, you'll be arrested. And so I said, well, I insist. So he arrested me. And at that point, they went through my black bag, took things out of my pockets, and had me with my hands up. Then at that point, somebody came along, a sergeant who I hadn't seen before, and said they could release me and I could treat the people. As far as I knew, I was still under arrest. They took my picture and so forth. I then went in to treat the people, came out and asked if I was still in the rest, and then nobody said anything, and I walked away. That's a good example of the kind of relation we had with the police. One other thing. I've been treating cases of mace, and so two of the people that were maced were arrested and were written up in the Chronicle, because it happens that a Chronicle reporter was arrested that same day, and many of these pictures and so forth relate to some of his photography work, I believe. At any rate, those two Chicano students were beaten unmercifully for an hour and a half by two plainclothesmen. And one of them was kicked in the orbit. He had a fractured, blowout fracture of the orbit, and in addition, he had a fracture of his wrist. And then I could go on with other atrocities on the campus, but I think we've had enough of that. I want to now talk about mace for a few minutes. Back about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago now, I think, they first started using mace against student demonstrators. The biggest time was at the Oakland Induction Center. That's when they broke it out en masse and gave it to most of the police officers there in Oakland. And that's when we first began seeing cases. Subsequently, the San Francisco police started using it after that. Apparently, this was all the police departments started using mace on the recommendation of the FBI. Mace is produced by the General Ordnance Equipment Company, and its composition is 1% standard tear gas, chloracetophenone. It contains about 80% freon, which is the propellant, and about 4% kerosene, and then there's another ingredient, methyl chloroform, at about 3 or 4%. But the most dangerous component is the tear gas. And the medical literature is full of cases of lost eyes and permanently injured eyes, scarred eyes, from tear gas. And so when I saw that this was being released to the police departments, I immediately went through the medical literature, picked up the more recent things, and then tried to get hold of some mace. Now, there was no way to get hold of mace. No police department would, the San Francisco Police Department wouldn't give it to me, nor would any other police department, nor would the manufacturer. Fortunately, though, one of the police here on campus at UC gave a sample to the Drug Information Center, and then it was transmitted to me. And then I had some, a very small amount, and I tested three rabbits, and one of the rabbits' eyes developed a permanent scar. After that, cases started coming in, and this confirmed what I thought, and that is that mace causes a severe tear gas burn of the eyes and skin, and is indeed a very dangerous kind of weapon to use. Now, just a brief word or two about our experience of it, what we did. We called a press conference and tried to release the information, and the Chronicle was very cooperative in getting it out. We then approached the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco and told them what the position of MCHR is and what we know about mace. Our position is, briefly, that mace has in no way been adequately tested by any manufacturer, and that it has not been cleared by any independent federal or local government agency. The Food and Drug Administration refused to look at it. The Surgeon General was finally pushed into making a statement, and his statement was that certain restrictions should be put on the use of mace, and talked about irrigation and distance of use and so forth, and how it should be treated with immediate irrigation by physicians. That's the only position that's been taken by the government, as far as I know, up to date. Now, there have been people who have been trying to find out. This was over a year ago. Recently, various lawyers and news people have been trying to find out what their tests have shown, the federal tests, because the Surgeon General said he was going to test mace. Well, this information has not been released, and nobody can get hold of it. Now, the use of mace at State College, after the Board of Supervisors resolution, we all felt fairly self-assured that our city is indeed run by some form of government and that the police are law-abiding citizens. However, at State College, in fact, they use mace, and they used it a great deal. In fact, got one picture, they were macing people right before they drew their guns. There's a picture on the front page of the Chronicle, I think it was December 11th, that shows an individual handcuffed on his belly on the ground, and San Francisco Police Department sergeant is macing him at about 8 inches in the face. And I could go on and on about the cases I saw from State College. But the use of mace was repeatedly in a very punitive, was used repeatedly very punitively. That is, people were maced after they were handcuffed, and arrested in the paddy wagon or on the way into the paddy wagon. And usually it was the police response to a verbal protest of some sort. Frequently no more than, what was I doing? Why am I arrested? You know, things like this. We've had other experiences. We approached the Berkeley City Council and tried to discuss with them restrictions on the use of mace, and they too are non-receptive. Our experience with public health officials here in San Francisco and Berkeley has been negative. They, in fact, have supported the use of mace as public health officials, that is Dr. Sox and Dr. Alvin Leonard in Berkeley, with some restrictions. Interestingly enough, though, their restrictions don't relate at all to the way mace has been used and is continued to be used. That's about all I want to say about mace. I think most of you probably are familiar somewhat with it anyway. I want to add one thing in addition. I believe that there are a number of other weapons under consideration by the police departments throughout this country, including the San Francisco police. None of these weapons are subject to any civilian review, as far as I know, or medical review. The use of tranquilizer guns, the use of other kinds of gases, either pocket tear gas spray gases or canisters, it seems to me all of these decisions seem to be made by the police themselves. Mr. Biddle, who's the head of the Assembly Criminal Procedures Committee here in California and decides about state law, is very favorable to the police use of all gases. We attempted to get our position in front of him, and he was very unreceptive and, as a matter of fact, made it almost impossible for us to do so. He held the hearing at a time when one person did make it, and then he held other hearings and didn't allow us to be heard here in San Francisco. He only wanted to hear police officers and what kind of training they were going to give their men in the use of gases. And so now laws are about to be passed which will allow the use of pocket tear gas devices and canisters in our federal prisons, in our juvenile detention homes, and, of course, by the Highway Patrol.
As a quote-unquote veteran of Washington last year, Columbia last year, San Francisco State this year, and part-time Berkeley, these are fairly typical. I don't know how many of you have gone to demonstrations or even seen any of these things, but at Columbia last year I saw pregnant faculty-wise being singled out and beaten with 5 and 6 inch gashes on their head, repeatedly hit in the stomach with police clubs. I have been beaten up at... I was beaten up in Washington, beaten up at Columbia, and beaten a little bit, not up, but just beaten a little bit at state, wrapped around a few times to teach me a lesson, cut my attitude. So I think, safely say these things will continue. They won't show it on your television screen. They... won't tell it to you on the top 40 station, but they are going on, and we do need help. And if you think that this is a recruitment pitch to join our organization, we'd be delighted to have you. So that's that. Now I'd like to introduce Dr. Carlos Fernandez from the Third World Liberation Movement to talk about whatever you're going to talk about. Dr. Fernandez is a psychiatrist in the... Berkeley part of the Bay Area.
I really am at a loss as to what to say. I would rather talk today not as a representative of the Third World or as a Chicano physician, but I would like to speak hoping that most of the people here are medical students, physicians, or people connected with the healing arts. And it's very distressing to observe the presentation of films like this, the portrayal of the brutality that's been perpetrated all over the society at all levels. And then to witness what I would call the massive denial, repression, compartmentalization of the evidence that all of us have witnessed, and see how we're able to, in spite of this, is going on and has been going on for quite a while, has been going on against my people for 100 years in this state, has been going on against the black people for 400 years at least in this country. And then it's, if I sound depressed, I am depressed, because we don't seem to have the techniques to make this confrontation with reality, to perform the healthy transformation that we hope to achieve when we confront our patients with the repetitive neurotic mechanisms that lead to their impoverishment of their own lives and of those around them, to maintain a precarious, a sort of everybody loses kind of balance, which seems to me is what we are witnessing in the maintaining of the status quo on our present society. The subject of racism is what we're seeing here, I think, is one example of it. Let me tell you what I think about racism. I think of it in terms of one of the varieties of a social psychopathological mechanism that encompasses all those, a set of ideas, attitudes, behaviors, social rules, institutionalized behaviors in society that are structured along the axis of an exploitative situation, meaning the setting of a dyad relationship in which one member of the dyad exploits the other member to maintain a precarious balance, emotional, social, economical, etc. Now, racism, I think, is just one aspect of this social pathology that chooses and elects the victim on the basis of racial traits, racial characteristics, or some signals like skin, like manners. But it is much more pervasive than just just as it's simplified by racial overtones. Most of the people who were being beaten here were not Chicanos, the one I saw, and they were a few blacks. There were many of, I imagine the majority were white people. So one cannot talk of racial, that this is motivated racially. Although racial response sort of refers to the kind of mechanism I'm talking about. Now, in order to maintain this equilibrium, it's necessary both that the two members of the dyad gain some kind of equilibrium, malignant equilibrium, precarious equilibrium, expensive equilibrium. And I think what distressed me observing responses like to the presentation of this film is the initial movement in the minds of all of us to erase it and say that it just moves us, it's horrible, the pigs are monsters, and you know, coughing is terrible, when we know now that diagnosis has been made now to satisfy it, I imagine anyone who thinks about it, that the illness of the society that is perpetuating and perpetrating this kind of crime is based on what was called in the Warner Report, racism, and the racist attitudes and rules, regulations, and laws, you know, that are institutionalized in the structure of the dominant white society. Yet, we know the diagnosis, we know the causative agent, and most of the efforts are directed at symptoms, at the policemen. Those policemen there are no different than any one of us. Subjected to the training that they are subjected, all of us will do the same or worse, because we have been repressing all kinds of rage much more than they have. We have had no avenue to vent it, or like come and shout and strike, shut it down, or protest, or stop the war. You know. We haven't had avenues. These people at least have dissipated. You know, the institution provides them with avenues, with a regular bullfight, you know, in which they can go and vent their brutal, sadistic impulses, and somehow that is drained off. Okay, what I'm trying to say, we forget that we are seeing the end product of some systematic training, degradation of those human beings to the point that they become pigs. They are victims of the same process that we are being subjected, and that what is scaring in the press means that this film, if we don't respond to it, really here and up here, we are being subjected to the same type of degradation. We are becoming inured to witness these examples of atrocities and respond so blandly. So blandly. If one were to pass a collection here, all over you, or a commitment of all of you, go back to your house, go back to your work, go back to your office, go back to your department, go back to wherever you are doing, and do something about it. No talk, no complain. Do something. The illness is right here in the people who create this building. This nightmare of a building. Is this a way to prepare physicians to treat human beings? How did you feel walking into these hallowed halls of learning? Is something so dead, so killing, so restricting, so... God, I've been thinking of, helping some of my third world people, some Chicanos who were trying to, get some education.